The E-Commerce Uncovered podcast is a behind-the-scenes look at what makes e-commerce a success in today's ever-growing and continually changing online world. The podcasts look to uncover the secrets of e-commerce success so you can learn and apply to your own online business. Brought to you by the co-founders of Core Fulfillment, one of the UK's leading e-commerce fulfillment providers, Paul Burns and Jeremy Vernon.
Hi, and welcome to another episode of E-commerce Uncovered. Today, we just really want to talk about a visit that Paul and I both had this morning. That visit was to the Marks & Spencer's Castle Donington Distribution Centre, which, just to put it in context, is, or certainly was, one of the biggest e-commerce warehouses in the country.
Yep.
When it was built, over 900,000 square foot of warehouse.
25 metres high.
And to put that in context, that's enough to store 12 jumbo jets, so I'm told. So a big, big warehouse. So this morning we have the privilege of being shown around the operation. We were very grateful to Nathan Seaburn, who is the operations manager for Marks & Spencer's at that site. We have, as I say, the privilege of going around there, and we just really want to talk a little bit about the takeaways that we brought away from that and the sort of observations that we had from that visit. So very relevant, obviously, to e-commerce. It's pretty much at the top end of where e-commerce is. It doesn't get much bigger than that in terms of an e-commerce operation.
I think you look at, you know, M&S as a brand, they're probably the longest serving name on the British high street. They're sort of a home housewife's favourite, you know, well known for their high-end food, clothing. I know they've had on and off battles with the clothing sales over the past 20 years, really. They seem to sort of change tack every now and again. But to see the setup they had today and hear some of the comments that Nathan were making about the current management team they have there is focused on getting 30% of all sales through e-com within, I think he said, by 2022?
I think he did, yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, they're obviously, it's sometimes we've talked about how it's more difficult for these big guys that are really established out there, you know, big retail networks, to change quickly. But they're, even those guys seem to be coming around to know that, that e-com is a major part of any business.
Okay, let's kick off with the sort of the experience of actually getting there. It's just at the bottom of the A50 near Derby, Castle Donington. Obviously, just a short drive off the A50, and you approach this absolutely humongous warehouse, brightly branded up with M&S, obviously get to park there. And sort of one of the first obvious things, certainly for me when we got into the security hut, was how seriously they take security.
Yeah, nobody was getting anywhere without dotting the I's and crossing the T's.
Notice as well that there's obviously we want to try and paint a picture here as well, because we've had the experience, we want to try and tell you what it was like and paint that picture, of give you a visual of how it was. So we arrived at the Castle Donington Distribution Centre. You obviously register with security, and then there's a colour sky bridge, isn't there, over into the sort of main warehouse. And did notice that when we went across that sky bridge, there is a police room. There's a dedicated police operation on site.
Yeah, well, I mean, they were saying, was it 600, 700 temporary members of staff they could have during peak? I think it's probably as much a visual deterrent as anything else, but saying to people, we're watching you guys, and security is something we take very seriously. But yeah, two police rooms, I think it was. Was it? Yeah, I think it was two there, yeah.
But I think it's a very bold statement, isn't it, for anyone entering the building, how seriously they take security.
Yeah, well, a lot of contractors on site as well, you know, with all the, we'll talk about it later, but all the automation they had there, all the sort of MHE stuff, they'll have contractors on site all the time. And I suppose the stuff they're storing there is highly desirable. You know, what, gifts and fashion and stuff like that. So I think they've definitely taken a strong stance on that.
Okay, we obviously met, as I've said, Nathan Seaburn, who's the operations manager there. We just had a bit of a presentation about how the business worked, the sort of structure of the people there, and sort of peak, what it looks like, up to 1,400 employees at peak, which obviously is a huge amount of people to manage. And just went through really how that site has developed, because it was been open now five year anniversary next week for the site. So it's the 5 years in, and they're only part way through their plan for that site. So we'll talk in a second, but he talked about the sort of the developments, mezzanine floors, all that sort of stuff that they're planning. But yeah, it was just an interesting interesting introduction, really, to such a vast site. So once we'd spoken to Nathan for a while, he took us on a tour, didn't he, of the actual site itself. Just one thing that obviously was very prominent today was they were on a deployment day. Now, what that means is that they have certain downtime scheduled in. So all of the automation, pretty much there was very few staff there in terms of operatives, so warehouse staff.
Yep.
They had a deployment day. So what that really is, it's downtime for the machinery. It can obviously essential maintenance take place, software upgrades, system upgrades, yep, coding upgrades, whatever's required for the system. So in some ways, it was actually great to see it not working, because it's a 24 operation, 365 days a year. So any other time, pretty much it would be a noisy, fast-moving environment.
Yeah, I got the impression that it wasn't affecting any of the orders going out today, because they've got, you know, you build this monster of a place to deal with essentially your capacity is your last 5-6 weeks of the year. So they still, I got the impression that this deployment and all the maintenance work they were doing wasn't going to affect the actual dispatch of consumer orders. So it would still have been painless for the consumer.
Yeah. So the tour we did, obviously this site, absolutely huge, 25 metres in height. So it's as tall as I've ever seen a warehouse. I mean, to put in context, our warehouse is, what, 11 metres?
11, 12, yeah.
So it's more than double the height of ours. There are three sort of main sections of the warehouse, and they call them chambers, which, yeah, I thought was quite an interesting way to describe it. So as you walked in, we went into the deep storage chamber and the pick face chamber, didn't we?
Yeah, so that was the sort of, I had some of the more sort of the box products, so none of the hanging that was in there, the hanging stuff, all the fashion was in the other end. So it was a deep storage, so slow moving goods, which they then, through automation, fed into the central chamber, I think. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah.
And that filled up the pick chamber. I'm trying to remember some of the numbers he gave us now. Was it 175,000 pick faces or
something like that?
Yeah.
It was. I've got some stats on the building here just to help put it in context. As we said, 900,000 square feet, 25 meter tall building. There is 17 kilometers of conveyors.
It's a lot.
Operates, as we've said, 365 days a year. Up to 2 million single items are processed every week at peak. There is over 9 miles of hanging garments. Now we'll come on to sort of that, what that looked like in sort of the tour. That was in chamber three, as they called it. One other thing that we'll talk about is 25 miles of solar PV panels, basically, on the roof. They also have this solar wall as well, which is something else we'll talk about. But yeah, up to 15 million products in that warehouse.
I think that we might jump around a bit here, but that hanging chamber, you know, I've not been around loads of warehouses, but that was probably the most impressive thing I've ever seen.
Well, it's floor to ceiling.
Just hanging garments, and no human ever enters it to pick an item. It's just fully automated, and it essentially brings it to a packer hundreds of metres away, probably thousands of metres away by the time it's done its full journey. But yeah, floor to ceiling, railed, all automated hanging garments. I've never seen anything like that.
No, it's obviously one of the reasons we wanted to do this podcast, really. It was just absolutely spectacular. And I'm sure if you work there, you soon get used to it and the sheer size and scale of it. But for someone who, you know, we all drive past these sort of big sheds, either on dual carriageways or motorways, and we typically will just drive and forget about it and don't really think about what goes on internally. But when you get to see sort of a behind the scenes look, it's absolutely awe-inspiring, the level of automation, the level of investment that they've made in this to obviously fulfill orders that you know, for M&S's e-commerce activities. So and it's their only e-com warehouse in the country.
In Europe, I think. It does their European stuff as well.
I believe they're planning another one, potentially as part of they've got around about £1 billion investment that M&S are making over a 10-year period. But at the moment, every e-commerce order, other than Uglies, so sort of rugs, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yep.
It is fulfilled from this particular site. So yeah, we went into chamber one, say deep storage and everything else in chamber one. And we noticed they were clearing an area, weren't they, in chamber one, where they're putting a 5-level mezzanine floor in, ready for peak this year.
Yep.
Which I think wasn't there. They were just starting to clear the floor for that.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, what are we now? We're beginning the Q2, so they will have, I think he said everything had to be in place by September 1st. They were saying if anything hadn't been sorted by then, it wouldn't be actioned in peak then. So technical deployments. So not, I mean, you're talking five levels of mezzanine and it hadn't started yet. You know, yeah. The space wasn't cleared in less than 6 months. That's,
and to work around it.
Yeah, and for the rest of the guys in the operation to work there as normal. That'd be impressive. I'd love to get back and see it once it's done.
Yeah. So we obviously left chamber one, moved into chamber two. So there's physical divides, isn't there, pretty much between these yep. chambers, presumably hence why they call them one, two and three. And that was into the pick, automated pick area, which, yep. again, just to sort of paint you a picture here of, it was really sort of, mezzanine floors. So mm-hmm. there's different levels to it, but pretty much the same on every level. And you had this sort of corridor, didn't you, that was flanked either side by automated pick faces.
Yep.
And then this corridor, which is where the pickers would stand in front of these machines. You understand it better than I do, but just describe what they did when they were picking from the pick face tote into the order tote.
Yeah, well, picking, if you imagine a warehouse where people go and pick product, and it may be, this might be a little bit outdated now, but generally you've got a person with a pick trolley or a pallet truck with either a piece of paper or a tablet telling them to go to position A, B, C, D, and they go and pick either products for individual consumers or multiple products for going into retail perhaps. M&S have taken this to another level, so their pickers don't actually have to walk anywhere. However big it is, must be a third of the building would be full of these grey bins that are stored up and within the automation, essentially. And as orders come in from their website, the system is telling it to take the tote to the picker. And on the top level, you had a tote that would turn up and it might have two or three different products in it. They find the right item. If it's got multiple items in there, they scan it and then they drop it through this beam of light into the blue tote, which is going to end up being packed by somebody somewhere else in the building. And so by dropping it through that light, that says, okay, there's one item in there. Either it's finished, it zips off and goes somewhere else, either to another packing station where it may await another item to go into it, or onto the packing guy to actually put it into an M&S bag or a box. Again, if there's multiple items in there, even if the same one, it makes them scan it. So the accuracy must just be through the roof. It can also get them to check the inventory of those items in that grey bin. So they're also stock checking their locations as they go along. But I think he said that he would have one person might man four of those stations.
Four or six of those stations. Yeah. So they would be doing four stations, yeah, as yeah. you say, for one picker.
Yeah.
Which one other sort of observation, which was good. Obviously, there's I can't remember how many stations there were, but these are quite big sort of machines that quite long with all the sort of pick faces behind, which you just can't get access to. That's all the automation side of it. But everything's done by light, isn't it? So you have a sort of a shift manager or an area manager. If there's any issues from the picker's perspective, there's a sort of a switch by their picking station and they would turn different coloured lights on for various different reasons of problems, whether it be a product is damaged, something's not there, or the actual picking station's gone down for whatever reason. So just a really very simple but very effective way of communicating through what is quite a big area.
They had communications everywhere to the staff to say, this is how we expect this area to be left. And that was one from a tidiness perspective, but also an efficiency perspective. If somebody comes in that area isn't right and they have to spend 10, 20 minutes, or it might be four areas if they're dealing with a four, sorting all that out, that is just dead time for those guys at the start of the next shift. So they really made it clear as to how they expected that to look when the next guy came in to start his packing.
Yeah. So went through that area, say that was chamber two.
Yep.
So we then moved into probably what the most spectacular from a, never really seen that before, into chamber three. And this really was just a vast wall of hanging garments, wasn't it? The full 25 metres in height, and it must have been depth-wise.
It was a third of the building, it must be 300,000 square foot of hanging garments.
Fully automated. Obviously, engineers would enter there for maintenance purposes, but other than that, it's complete auto-pick.
Yep.
And they were saying that each hanger has its own tag, doesn't it?
So RFID tag, so they know where it is in the building at all times.
And I'm sure there's over 600,000 garments in there.
Yep.
I'm sure there were.
I think he did say 640,000, yeah.
Yeah, which just to see it was spectacular. Again, there's an element of that third chamber that they were redoing. They were adding another level in, and there were at the back of there is all the cranes and everything else.
They had sales stock in there as well. They had end-of-line stuff that they would process out manually, yes. Yeah. But there was... I know today wasn't a particularly busy day, but I don't think nobody picks in there. It just goes into the middle chamber again to have the packing completed.
Yeah, so just in terms of what orders would come out of there, so any of the, the e-com orders that you would obviously place online for M&S come out of there. Also, they don't call it click and collect, do they? They call it shop your way.
Yep, which, delivery to store.
Yeah, so that obviously they had a separate packing operation for that, because obviously they would just basically collate orders for all of the online orders that would be picked up in store. Typically, they said, typically on a Friday, people would order Friday, pick up on a Saturday when they're in the store.
But almost no demand for order on a Saturday, pick up on a Sunday in store. They had a really good understanding of, or they were getting, I know they were doing a lot of work on it, but what their customers actually wanted.
But I thought what was interesting, we ran through a few of the stats with Nathan before we actually had a look at the operation itself. And he was talking about the factors that could influence that day's order volumes, and they literally do it by hour. So they would have a projection of each hour of the day, and obviously it's a 24-hour operation. They'd have a projection of what orders would come in. They know the profile of those orders by day, which is fine. We see that as well in our business, certainly not on a 24-hour basis though. But they were saying things like, if Holly Willoughby wore an M&S top on this morning, then that would just spike the orders and throw that forecast out completely. Yep. And it would be so instant, which I guess you don't really think about stuff quite that quickly. But I mean, we see it with influencers, with some of our customers that, yeah, one night they may post their video on YouTube or Instagram or wherever, and we'll see a spike post that. But this was pretty much instant, wasn't it?
Yeah, and that, I think, businesses that have always been e-commerce businesses probably used to dealing with that, but typical marketing for a retail giant like M&S is probably 2 or 3 months of getting the right imagery together to go into a magazine or a leaflet or in the store or onto TV ads. So they're all quite slow call to actions in comparison to Holly Willoughby tweeting a picture of her wearing an M&S top and saying, got this little top from M&S, and instantly there are 5 million people that could see that. And it may even have a link that takes, you know, the call to action is so quick and so direct, as opposed to somebody who may leaf through a brochure that's come through the door. And that individual was in the past would have had to go to the store to get it. So it's so quick and so reactive. And we've seen it in our business where somebody might not be hitting numbers and they decide to put a promotion on one night. These companies are so big that they don't necessarily tell the ops guys, oh, by the way, we've put a promotion on. And they come in and they'll see all those stats skewing out. So the automation can only help deal with that, I think.
So I think we just wanted to obviously talk to you about the sort of the experience that we had this morning. We really wanted to get it sort of recorded and understand a little bit more about it. But there's some takeaways that we've got really. So really just want to end this with really what we learned from today's visit. Because whilst it was spectacular and, you know, all very great, huge amounts of automation, huge amount of investment's gone in there, what did we, as obviously warehouse owners ourselves, or certainly in our warehouse that we've got, what did we take away from that? Because it's very much at high level.
Yeah, I think the first thing we both noticed when we walked into the building, it felt like you were walking into an M&S store.
The brand was absolutely on point.
Yeah, in that, you know, all the guys had the branded jackets on and the T-shirts. Quite often I can imagine a warehouse would be nothing like the store, but M&S hadn't done that at all. The reception desk, the wall, it literally looked like we were walking into an M&S store that had a warehouse on the back of it. And it was all very professional, you know, from the guy on security, very polite, and then up to the sort of reception lady. Dealt with really, really nicely and, you know, made very welcome. It was a really good intro. But I think the first thing that, since we got into the warehouse element, was how much focus there still is on the customer being at the heart of everything. You know, they had all the messaging up, and I think it was, you know, every order matters. That sort of ethos they would definitely have with the frontline staff in a store was being pushed onto the guys in the warehouse element who never meet a customer. But it was really prominent that getting that order right into the customer on time was their number one objective.
But they're dealing, you know, they had these areas within the warehouse that sort of had these, there were whiteboards, but they were like a matrix on it, had a pre-set out way of working, and then they could obviously just each day write in the numbers, and it was all about how many orders had failed or how many had failed to go out that day and what particular reason. Nothing new there, but the level of detail
that
they went to, to look at how they improve. Continuous improvement obviously is something that we're adopting, but they've adopted to an absolute nth degree.
Yeah.
And it was just amazing just to see how each day they would look at the stats, the KPIs, and learn what they've learned on that particular day to make sure that that never happens again.
And the way that they communicated that down to the entire team was incredible. You know, there was, they had areas where they would assemble everyone first thing at the start of that shift, I think, and talk to them about it. And that was another thing that, you know, when I think about our business, as much as it's moved on, the way they communicated to staff was incredible, you know, visually.
Well, they had the TVs, didn't they? So
yep.
The operations manager, the general manager,
yeah.
who wasn't there actually when we were there, but the general manager does a talk to the senior leadership team of how the last week went, and then obviously how what's planned for this week. But that gets videoed and put onto TV sets all around the warehouse, and it's on a sort of a continuous loop. So people are completely and utterly aware, whether you're a cleaner, whether you're a forklift driver, whatever, you get to see what everyone else is hearing. I just think that level of communication was really, really good to see.
Yeah, the staff area we seen when we walked in was, you know, they had some computer points where people could log on their breaks or whatever it might be, and they had communications from all the sort of the heads of department. I really got the impression that they cared about the staff, which, and you know, without naming names, I've been around another couple of places this year, and actually now that I've been there, I realised how much they didn't communicate to their staff. The chap that we're with today, Nathan, he was talked about, you know, finding out about what staff interests were, what other value could they add to the business, and promoting that, you know, that they should come forward and talk about it. And we've seen a good example of that in action. A guy that used to be on the shop floor was upstairs, and he was pulling together reports from, was it hundreds of sources of data?
Yeah, but he's doing obviously like an internally developed BI system, and it was using VBA, so it was just basically using spreadsheets, but obviously macros to pull all this data. Now, they've got their own BI, they've got stuff within the system, but I think like any system, because they're using so many different systems, has so many different sources of information, pulling all of that together can be quite a headache. I mean, we run BI in our business, and that runs from various different sources, and we know how challenging that can be. But this guy just showed, obviously, a real talent for this. As you say, they picked him. He was on the shop floor as a temp, and they just discovered that he had the skill. And in fact, he was a programmer by trade.
Yep.
I don't think he sort of went in with that saying, I'm a programmer, I need to help this. I think they just discovered he had that talent, and now he's helping them manage the business on a really minute detail level.
Yeah, his line manager had noticed that he was really good at using the system at every level they had showed them, and just flagged it up, and they've picked up on it and done something with it. It's a really great story.
But the sort of the way they would nurture talent just is incredible to see. And I think M&S has a very much an ethos of that, and that comes across in terms of the shops. But to see it in a warehouse environment, and see that they actually do that in reality, was just great to see.
Absolutely, yeah.
What else did we take away?
Green credentials, I've put down here.
Yeah. Just the building itself, there's a couple of things that we noticed and we got talking about. The site itself is carbon neutral, which for such a big site, is quite impressive. And there's a couple of things here that I think you would probably never know if you didn't know about it, but we were told. One, that when the site was built, so sort of 5 years ago, the concrete, and I presume this is the base now, underneath the base, the hardcore underneath the base, was actually recycled from a former power station that was not too far away when it was demolished. So really ethically built, really the part of the sort of Plan A that the M&S...
Well, they jumped on that early, didn't they? The carbon neutral stuff, yeah.
So it really in line with their values, which again is great to see. But there was, we mentioned it in the stats, there's 25 miles of solar panels on the roof of this place. And obviously you can imagine the roof is pretty big.
That was the most in Europe when it was built, I think he said as well today.
And so that produces in excess of the power that they are required to run the site. So considering this is a fully automated site, the electric requirement must be huge. Yep. But due to the level of investment they made in the PV, they're actually selling electricity back to the grid. So it's actually producing an income rather than consuming electric, yep. which is fascinating. And the other thing they have is on the presumably the southern aspect of the build, they have what they call a solar wall. And this absorbs heat from the sun and helps heat the building. So again, I also believe that was the largest solar wall installation in Europe as well. So obviously, when they built this in mind, they built it with the eco-credentials that the M&S live by, which yep. obviously is part of their plan A.
So it's just, you hear these things, it's nice to see them really in effect, you know, which you big companies talk about, you know, carbon neutral and stuff all the time. It doesn't always mean that much as a consumer, but to see it in the flesh was really cool.
Okay.
We've covered it a little bit already, but just it's worth mentioning again, the level of automation that they had. I think I read somewhere that it was about 125 million of investment in automation. That is planning in advance like I've never seen before. That's absolutely incredible amount of investment.
The flow room, as they called it, which is a control room to you and me.
It's like an air traffic control in there, yeah.
Was going in there, there was just huge TVs, obviously with all the CCTV of the system and they could see whether it was working, and literally rows and rows of PCs running all sorts of clever software, and they had 3D maps of the building and they could look at which automation element was
on and off and not working and being
serviced. So colour-coded, so it'll flash red if there's a problem. And just, it was quite impressive, just been able to say, they call it the flow room, but it was a really impressive place to be, wasn't it?
Yep.
And you could, it was obviously the control hub of the building.
Yeah.
But you could see the level of investment that's been made just by being in that room.
Yeah, I think we've, again, had some other experience of automation where guys have... And automation is amazing, but if you don't get it right or don't plan far enough ahead, it can be very much a limiting factor in your success, because if it can only process X amount per day and all of a sudden you're exceeding that, you're kind of stuck at that point. So but that, I certainly didn't get that impression today at the M&S place.
No, not at all.
And then the last point I had was 95% of all the e-com stuff was clothing, which I found astounding. You know, my experience of shopping in M&S is a little bit of food, a little bit of homewares, and obviously a lot of clothing. Now, I'm not sure what their particular demographic is, but it's probably not me. And I know, as we mentioned earlier, they've had this on and off battle with how to make their clothing work. And sort of, I can't remember how long ago, it must be 10 years ago, maybe even longer, they had the, David Beckham was a front man of the brand, of a sort of internal brand called Blue Harbour, to kind of get that going. And since then, I'm sure they've had Jamie Redknapp as well. So I think they're obviously a big player in clothing on the high street, but I'm not sure they've found that sweet spot as yet to translate that online, and especially for that younger demographic, the fast fashion guys. You know, we read an article the other day that said ASOS now sold more garments of clothing than M&S. Now, ASOS, I don't think it's been going 20 years. M&S has been going over 120 years. So it's very easy for us to say this, we're not running a huge big retail brand, but I wonder if there's some merit to spinning up a new brand that people might not necessarily know as part of M&S, but using your buying power, using that facility they've got there. We certainly see this in e-commerce. You know, we're about to start working with a client who has done some incredible volume in less than 3 years of starting a clothing brand online. And so I do wonder if there's some merit in that. I'm sure they've thought about it as smarter people than me there, but that facility could do so much for them. It doesn't necessarily have to be all under M&S's brand.
Yeah. Okay, I hope you found that useful, really, because to say, we just really wanted to try and paint a picture, really, of what we experienced today. Obviously, a video would have been great, but really, that wouldn't suit the podcast, of course not. So really, hopefully, the sort of our description and going through it has given you an idea, really, of the sheer scale that this place was in. It was a great, great experience just to go around there and see how a tier one retailer works from an e-commerce perspective. Okay, well, thank you for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye-bye.